What's the plan? Is there a
Well,
plan, or is it just we're going to do some experiments and see what happens?
it's called beat the tar out of the process engineer until they get the defects down. The whole point in my mind, being a DFM disciple, is to have the discussion up front with the designers so we know what to expect.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Altium On Track podcast. I'm your host, Zach Peterson. Today, we'll be talking with Chris Shea, president of Shea Engineering. Chris is involved in developing test vehicles for soldering, and I'm very eager to learn about what she does and some of the work she's doing involving UHDI. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Zach, for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely, we're happy to have you here. I've said many times, I've been trying to make it my point to learn a bit more about what happens with manufacturing beyond just DFM, so I'm really excited for this.
Excellent. I studied DFM in grad school, so I've been a disciple from Boothroyd Dewhurst for the last 35 or 40 years. So I love this stuff.
Awesome. That's great. If you could just tell us what it is you do.
I've been an SMT assembly process engineer since 1990. So I've gone from 25 mil pitch to copper pillars. And it's been a great, great journey. I spent my first 20 years in the industry, roughly 10 on the user side, running assembly lines and NPI lines and doing DFM. And the next 10 working on the supplier side, developing materials and new processes. And 15 years ago, almost 60 now, I decided to strike out on my own, and I've been an independent consultant ever since. Now I've been given the moniker the Queen of Soldering, and I don't take that lightly. I'm very appreciative of that.
Well, Your Highness. This is interesting. I didn't know that there were SMT, soldering consultants. I didn't even know that was a thing.
It's kind of a niche. I don't advertise. I don't do any marketing. I don't do any sales. It's more or less word of mouth, and it's been really, really fulfilling for a long time now.
That's awesome. That's awesome. It's always great when you can, strike out on your own and really do something that you want to do and get that recognition.
The passion for making solder joints. I love making
I
solder
feel
joints.
it. I feel it. So one of the things that I saw that you do is develop test vehicles for soldering. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you were recently involved in creating a rather complex test vehicle for UHDI assembly.
Yes, indeed. What we did with it was we developed a test vehicle for solder paste printing several years ago, probably 5, 6 years ago. We introduced it in 2019. And it was originally used for solder paste printing tests, and it embedded 25 different paste tests into one board. So an assembler can, within half a shift, decide whether or not this is the right paste. And you can rank them all on a scale and pick the best paste for their assembly operation, and also know going in what the trade-offs are. So since we introduced that as a simple solder paste test vehicle, we've used it for paste printing, evaluating stencils, evaluating all the new nano coatings that have come out, evaluating the new types of squeegees that have come out, looking at how thin we can go on a fab before we need solid board support, looking at how we underwipe the stencil, the different types of solvents we can use. That's printing. Then we go to placement, and this has been used to develop 0105 and 008, 004 assembly processes. And you notice I say uh-oh instead of oh-oh, because when you see them on a bill of materials, we all go, uh-oh, 8, uh-oh, 4s. We've also used it to prove in 0.4 millimeter BGA capability. And an interesting one that I got feedback on recently was placement rate verification, because in the SMT placement world, we have placement rates per IPC standards, because, and everybody does their test a little bit differently. So these guys took the board, and we do a thing where we put sticky tape on, double-sided sticky tape, and place away, and then verify the placement. So we were able to verify placement rates and placement locations. Then when we get to reflow, we've used it for voiding on bottom termination components, QFNs, transistors, and the 08 004s, which are now in your telephone. And we've also used it to develop a lot of design rules. Mask versus metal-defined pads based on feature size, square versus circular pads, optimizing our aperture designs for these small pads. So personally, we've done a whole lot with it, and a lot of the large CEMs and OEMs have adopted it to use as their test vehicles. Sometimes they modify it. The PACE labs use it. So it's gotten a lot of mileage, but it was originally designed for the 3 to 5 year time frame. And we've reached that time frame. So it was time to spin it.
Okay.
And that's how we come to the Ultra HDI.
Sure. And now that we get down to 25 mil line and spacing, I'm sure that creates a couple of challenges, right? One would be density. And then what's the other challenge? Maybe, let's say, pad sizes?
Pad sizes and density. You hit them both right on the head. Because, well, if I give you the good news, bad news, the good news for assemblers is we haven't gotten any components smaller than the 08-04s. The bad news is we're packing them in and greater quantities and higher densities, and we're even taking those tiny little pad sizes and shrinking them even below IPC min material condition to fit them all on the board. So what Ultra HDI is bringing to assembly is just a lot more of the same challenges in greater quantities. I've been an SMT process engineer for 35 years. The three certainties in my life are death, taxes, and miniaturization. It's been coming for 35 years and it will keep coming. And it's what keeps us, intrigued, employed, and inspired, I guess.
Now, this is interesting. You mentioned that pad sizes being shrunk down IPC minimums under which standard is that? I think 7351.
7525.
So was IPC not anticipating this, or do they always just wait for people to do stuff and then develop the standard later?
Well, because the standards are developed on experience, we have to get the experience before we can develop the standard. It's sort of a chicken and the egg.
So, and then in the test board, if you could just hold it up for us for just a moment, because you flashed it on screen briefly. I want to give people just a quick view and maybe a description of what we're seeing here. But what we're seeing here is it looks like we have a lot of different components. I'm assuming there's no routing, but we have pads and everything for a lot of different components, all kind of gridded out and lined up in their own areas. What are some of the components that are on here? I know you mentioned really small SMD passives, but it looks like there's probably some spots for maybe QFNs.
Yes, these are 05 BGAs, 0.5 millimeter pitch. These are a little tough to see. They're 0.4 millimeter BGAs. And coming down the side are 0.3 millimeter BGAs. Then in here, we've got 0.4 QFNs, which is the finest pitch we can get. And it was a legacy board where we had some 1206s, some 0603s, some 0402s, all of which have been removed for the next version. We've got 0201s, 01005s, and our favorite 08-04s. Now, this board was good for testing pace, but it really didn't push the miniaturization levels the way the new board pushes the miniaturization levels or the packing density levels.
Okay. I encourage anyone who's listening on audio to come over to YouTube and check this out so they can actually see what one of these boards looks like.
And if you want to see a good picture of it, SheaSMT.com, if you go to SMTA board, there's some nice pictures of the top and bottom sides.
There we go. Perfect. One thing I'm wondering here is, we're talking about a test vehicle that seems like it's seen pretty extensive use over the last several years. How common is it for a manufacturer to use these kinds of boards to maybe qualify their process either for high volume or high complexity manufacturing?
The big CEMs, the top tiers, all have their own internal test vehicles. The tier two on down generally don't. So to buy this board for roughly $30 is way more economical than using one of your own production boards. And it has a lot more tests in it. There's actually 25 different solder paste tests and DOEs embedded in that design. So it's quicker, it's cheaper, and it's more efficient What's not to love?
So that's interesting, right? They're using a test vehicle, but I would think, at least for quality control, they might actually use one of the production boards, or maybe just the surface layers from a production board, because, you know, they don't need all the internal routing. They really just need the pads if all they're trying to do is qualify soldering. Is that correct?
Exactly. And these are actually routed out to Goldfingers. They're all daisy chain components, and they're routed out to Goldfingers so you can put it in a thermocycling chamber to prove out your soldering process.
Got it. Okay. So it sounds like pretty much every assembler is going to need some kind of test vehicle in order to prove out their process at some level. And then they can reliably go to their customers and say, hey, we can do 0201s, 01005s.
Exactly. And it's a lot easier to do it on a test vehicle than on your customer's board, which may be consigned, or your own miniaturized board, which we know are more on the higher cost range than your standard boards. So it just makes sense for a lot of people to use this. And sometimes we use it to gauge a process to see how fine a pitch a contract manufacturer can go. Maybe they're qualified at 05 BGA, they're marginal at 04, and they have no capability at 03. So it's good to be able to benchmark that so they can communicate better with their OEMs as to what their capabilities are or where they need to improve.
So now in the new test vehicle, it sounds like, is really kicking up the density into a new level, right? We already hit 008, 004. Now it's really packing them into a small space. So what does this new test vehicle look like?
Let me share my screen and show you what we've got cooking here. Right now, I'm referring to this as the mechanical because we've only got our top layers, and we'll share the vision for the inner layers. Can you see this now? This is our new SMTA test vehicle. You see, we're now up to revision 2.3 from 2.1.
Okay. So really, really quick, for everyone that's out there listening on audio, we see same kind of thing. We have groupings of components in different regions of the board. It looks like a lot of those same kind of components. And I even see what looks like some rotation of some of those groups of components.
Yes, miniaturization is bringing us a lot more what we refer to in assembly as off-axis placement. Most of our placements historically have been at 0 or 90, horizontal or vertical. But as we get into denser and denser packaging, we're seeing a whole lot more at 45s. A few here at 30 and 60 degrees, but we didn't put them on the board. And there's always that odd angle somewhere where only 17 degrees would fit. The issue with the off-axis placements is not necessarily the printing or the placement or the reflow. Those are all still pretty straightforward, but we get into trouble when we get this dense packing and these off-axis placements, and we look for automatic inspection. The automatic optical inspection was not developed over the years for off-axis placement. So we run into things like shadowing, and we have small components. So this is going to help us refine our algorithms moving forward.
I see. Okay. So what kinds of things do we have on this board here? It looks like along the top, we have some of the BGAs.
Yes. And let me explain a little bit why some of these layouts look a little curious to us. There's a situation in stencil printing solder paste that we call the leading edge effect. The first few pads in any stencil squeegee stroke direction always have a huge amount of variation, much more than the third or fourth row of pads. And that's because we have to get that paste rolling and sheared down. We just don't get it sheared down enough until we hit the first few rows. So we've documented the leading edge effect. Some of the stencil printer companies have put in features to try to overcome it. But what we're doing here is we're staggering the BGAs and putting dummy pads in front so we can absolutely quantify the leading edge effect. And once we quantify it, then we can address it through stencils, through squeegees, through machine variables. So this is the first test vehicle we've got where we can really zero in on that leading edge effect. So you'll see we've got 1, 2, 3, 4 of these 04 BGAs right where we would put them at the leading edge. And we've offset these three and added the dummy pads. And what we'll end up seeing when we print this is A1, row A on this device will print far better than row A on that device. How much? That's what we're going to find out when we start running this.
If I could, when you say better, right, print better, what exactly does that mean?
And printing, the name of the game is reducing variation.
Got it.
When
okay.
We look at our solder paste deposit volumes, we want them to all be within, we use what we call a coefficient of variation. We want everything to be within 10% of the mean. And that means our process in control. If we get variations that are over 15% of the mean, it means our process is out of control. And when we're doing things this small, we need our process in control.
Sure. So that top row in these VGAs where it's along the deposition direction, those would get hit first.
Yes.
Those better just means that row looks a lot more like all the other rows. Yeah. So what we have here on screen is a couple of graphs. We have a bar chart and we have a line chart that I guess is quantifying the variation due to the leading edge effect on BGAs.
Exactly. And this was on 0.4 millimeter BGAs from the old version of the board. Now that we have a new version, this is suddenly the old one. And you can see row one, when it came to solder paste deposition, it was a little lighter than row two or row three. These were with different whites. But also you see the variation on row one. Even the best was out of control. We were at about 18%. This is 25% variation. This is 30% variation. When we get down to row three, we're back pretty much in control. We want less than 10. We're okay with less than 15. So we've got the green and the yellow dots there. So that really illustrates that first row is out of control. The difference in deposits is too great, and we're going to end up with either opens or shorts, mostly opens in that first row. Once we get to the third, we're in really good shape.
So is the message here to the designer to basically say, hey, designer, you need to add at least two rows of dummy pads along that printing direction? Or is this something is this something the assembler has to come in and do after the fact? Because I could imagine a really complex, very dense board that comes in and is being reviewed, and somebody says, hey, designer, you need to add these pads here. Oh, I'm sorry. That means these 50 components now need to move back by, you know, a millimeter, which, you know, when you're in the HD, I mean, even in the standard complexity region can be a game changer for you.
Yeah. I can ask, but I know I'm not going to get.
Sure.
So what we do in the printing domain is we're really, as things get denser, we're really starting to witness more and more. This has been, shall I say, process engineer lore for at least 10 years. And now we're seeing it more and more. So now we're testing for it more and more. We can't add pads. Gosh, if only we could. What we do is things like speed up the squeegee speed until we get to the print area, so we get a little bit more shear going, or we start the squeegee moving farther away from the print area so we can get a little bit more movement and get a little bit more shear in it. And I've actually got an idea that I can't share yet, but
okay,
there's a solution to that problem here. If I disclose it, I won't be able to patent it, so we'll talk about that in a little while.
Okay. After you get that patent, let's have you back on to talk about it for sure.
Right.
This sounds interesting. So one thing I noticed in the test vehicle was those BGAs, right? Most of that center area is carved out in the test vehicle and there are no pads. But if you look at, you know, most BGA components, they actually fill the entire underside of the package with pads. So why was the test vehicle designed such that you know, central square of pads was omitted?
That is designed that way because we are using dummy components, and this is how the dummy components are designed. Trust me, when we look at three rows on a periphery, or actually this is the one, four rows on a periphery, that's enough for us to handle. If we come over here and look at the O3 BGA, you see a lot more density, and you also do see the the pads and the IOs in the middle.
I see. Okay. So I was looking at the wrong BGAs.
Well, you know, we see all different kinds of BGAs. It just depends. But for our intents and purposes, because we want to show electrical continuity, we need to use the daisy-chained ones.
Yeah, this is very interesting. And then I see you also still have the gold fingers going along the edges as well.
Yes. So most of these components have a single daisy chain that routes out to the gold fingers. Because these are so challenging, they actually have two daisy chains, one for the inner array or perimeter array and one for the inner array. Because what we do is we put these in chambers, we thermally cycle them, we monitor the resistance, and we can predict when a joint is cracking.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, just by watching the resistance in real time.
Yes, yes. Because as the crack propagates through the joint, the cross-sectional area that's conducting the electricity gets smaller.
Starts to go down.
And it's back to your high school physics from there.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. So that would only be for joints on the surface, right? That's not like an internal feature like a microvia?
No, it's not. But you just hit on the beauty of this redesign and using the daisy chain. When we daisy chain these on the, you'll see all the connections are on the top layer right now. And the other connections are made within the component. My vision for this board is we punch through vias and pads. We put some blind vias in, we connect internally, and maybe even through some buried vias, and then come back up to the pads. So instead of having this one little trace tying these, we would actually punch through, go through the insides of the board, and punch back up, replacing the
surface. Right, so for anyone who's listening on audio, we do have small traces connecting neighboring pads. But what you're talking about is, let's get rid of the traces. Let's throw some microvia in pad in there.
Indeed.
And then possibly even stack blind and buried microvia pad?
Yep. The world is our oyster. We can try all different kinds of things. Ideally, I'd like to try one type of connection on one perimeter array and then another type in the next and another type in the next. Because that will be easier for us to find out where our opens show up.
Right, because then I guess somebody could do like, you know, there's just one line along the board where they would need to cut to do a microsection.
Yes, yes.
I see, okay. So you've got, let's say, 25 different microsection tests built into a single part of the coupon.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, that's really cool.
One of the things we do is design a lot of DOE and exploration opportunities into these test vehicles.
Do you get requests for like custom test vehicles?
Yes, we do. And
because I see SMTA's logo is on here, but I could imagine, you know, let's say Lockheed Martin wants their own test vehicle. Raytheon wants their own test vehicle.
I've worked with a number of assemblers on the original test vehicle. When they want customization, we're able to do it. And if you look right here in this big open space I'm showing, we call that Green Acres.
Green Acres, okay.
Green Acres, so we can put anything anybody wants down there. The SMT logo on the board, we have a royalty agreement. 10% of the purchase price of any of our boards goes to the SMTA to foster the next generation of engineers for workforce development and student young professionals. So we're really proud of that because we love bringing the young kids up.
Yeah. I think it's extremely important. I think that's great that you're doing that. One thing here also on the left, again, for anyone who's listening on audio, there looks like a section here on this board that is separated from the main board using some mouse bites. Why do you have this other breakaway section on this test board?
This is really cool. Surface insulation resistance becomes more and more important as feature sizes shrink and biases increase. So in short, surface insulation resistance is the conductivity of your flux residues or any residues that were left behind. When we're using high-speed signals, we can get a lot of crosstalk. When we're in harsh environments, salt fog, things like that, we can get dendritic growth, particularly in humid environments. So we've got some IPC test coupon designs for surface insulation resistance, but they're indicative of our industry 10 to 15 years ago. Now that we're getting into miniaturization and 25 micron space and trace, we have to rethink our SIR combs. So what we've done is reserved this space on both sides of the board for some developmental surface insulation resistance tests. And while you can't see them on this side, the back side of this tab is gold fingered so that we can plug them into the SIR chambers, run them under heat, humidity, and different biases, and monitor the continuity and see when we get the shorts.
I see. Okay, that makes perfect sense. I was even kind of envisioning in my mind, once you start doing micro VA and pad, that that could also be its own breakaway region. That way you could just, you know, microsection that part of it while leaving the rest of it intact.
Yes. Yes, we can. Indeed.
Okay. Makes a lot of sense. So I think as more of the UHDI packaging capacity comes back stateside, a lot of fab houses are going to, of course, trying to be upgrading their capabilities to, you know, take advantage of that new market. And we're already seeing that a little bit. I mean, you have ASC and I think Calumet who have been going that direction. And they're probably going to look at MSAP or SAP as the advanced processing technique for fabrication. So where does a test vehicle like this apply in this area? Does it apply in the microvia and pad portion where you have to then fabricate those vertical interconnects?
It applies there, and actually it applies in a number of other places too. If you look at these wafer level packages here,
okay,
we cannot create those with a subtractive etch process.
Okay.
We can try, but we're not going to do a good job at it, okay? These things need to be made additive or semi-additive. We've been working with ASC on some of these design elements, and we plan on including a lot more as we move forward on the board.
Okay, so this is not just a PCB test vehicle. Now this is really a packaging test vehicle as well.
Yes. Yes. I'm looking forward to putting some internal Ultra HDI layers in here to checking micro vias and pads, buried vias, blind vias, stacked buried vias. I think it's going to be really, really illuminating for a lot of us. And we're talking about not just testing the fabrication process, but the different materials that come from the different laminate suppliers, so we can understand which ones are more compatible than others when we start going to higher levels of production on Ultra HDI.
Yeah, I totally glossed over the material end of it, because I know that buildup materials are going to become more important, and I'm still kind of waiting for something to come around and replace Ajinomoto buildup film. For packaging. So this looks like the perfect vehicle to start testing some of that.
It is. And it's exciting because I know just about enough about fabrication to be dangerous, but I'm really specialized in assembly. So now I'm getting my feet a little more wet in fabrication and Ultra HDI. And it's a wonderful learning experience for me, as well as probably everybody else in the industry. One of the things we plan on doing is, if I can zoom into these caps and resistors, these are also dummy components, and we plan on electrifying these. Right now we have test points so the assembler can ohm them out and see if they got all their joints right. But what we want to do is punch down into the board. We're going to add a battery and some LEDs so you can instantly tell if your fabrication and your assembly works. It's kind of like a mini in-circuit test on board.
And I see. So they would have the board powered up, and while it's running, they could see the LEDs.
Yes. That will tell you if you assembled it properly. It'll also tell you if you fabricated it properly. I really thought that was a good idea, because it's a bit tedious to take a multimeter and start ohming these out. It's way more fun to push the switch and see what lights up. Come on.
Going back for a moment just to the microvia in pad, what sizes are you targeting? Because you mentioned going down to, you know, 0.3 millimeter pitch, right? And of course that, you know, pushes the pad size smaller. I'm just wondering, like, how small would you plan on going with microvia in pad?
I would love to be able to answer that, but it's not in my wheelhouse. That is a question for John over at ASC.
So they're the ones that are picking the lasers, and they're going to know how fine they can drill.
Yeah, they're the fabrication experts, definitely.
Sure.
Yes.
So it sounds like at some point there's going to be it sounds like there's going to be a test vehicle with the ASC logo, and that's their test board for their fabrication as well as assembly.
Yes, in fact, at the Ultra HDI conference, you'll see an early prototype of this board that's been fabricated by ASC. That
Okay,
was
very cool.
in plating yesterday or the day before. So John's going to be bringing them out to the Ultra HDI symposium with him.
Wow, we should have him on to talk about it. That would be pretty interesting. All
We
right.
should. Do you want to see some of the other features we put on here? They're more
Yeah,
assembly related, but.
absolutely. Love the show and tell session for sure.
Okay, well, again, we call these flower power because when they're powered up, they will light up and they kind of look like flowers. If we move.
Oh, okay. So these are the arrays of
Of capacitors
it
and
says,
resistors.
yeah, capacitors and resistors. Yeah, so it says caps minimum, resistor minimum, and then you
Yep.
have it looked like six in total.
Yep. And then we have the nominal IPC footprints, the max material condition IPC footprints, and the min material IPC footprints. And
I
what I've
see.
found in previous studies is when we compare nominal, max, and min, obviously max gives you the best quality output. But if we're going for miniaturization, we can't use the maximum pads. We have to squeeze this in. So we've done tests on both resistors and capacitors in these sizes where we compare the three pad sizes. And even though max is great, it's just not feasible in most designs. The difference between max and nominal on defect rates is pretty small relative to the difference in defect rates between nominal and minimum. When you hit the minimum, you really jack the defect rates up. So what we've determined over the years is that nom is pretty much the best. If you had space for the max, you wouldn't be using these tiny parts. And what this is going to allow us to do now is DFM rules is to determine on these smaller components, do we need nominal? Do we need minimum? Can we make an educated decision when we're laying out our board, whether we want to accept the higher defect rates or we want to accept the lower real estate. Going to give us a lot of insight into design for manufacture.
Now, about the jacking of the defect rates when you go to minimum, the minimum footprint size or pad size, I should say. What exactly are those defects? Are these too little solder, too much solder? Is it like tombstoning or shifting that leaves an open?
We get tombstones, we get skews, we get midship solder balls. We get non-wets
It
and
sounds like there's just the complete list.
there is there's
You've
probably
hit
six
most of
different
them,
forms.
right?
Yeah, there's probably six different forms that we use of defect code. So yeah, so gosh, I'm trying to remember back to the study, but let's say in here we might be 1,000 ppm.
Okay.
In here we might be 2,000 ppm. In here, we're like five or six. It was a huge, huge difference.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, I would have to go back and look at the numbers from the study, but it was a very remarkable difference. So our logic told us don't use the max, use the nom, try not to use the min.
So it really sounds like fabricators, or not fabricators, but assemblers need to have some kind of strategies here for what they're going to do when they start finding more boards that are using pads even below the minimum IPC standard size.
And you know what? I'm working on boards now that use even below the IPC minimum just because we have to get the density.
What's the plan? Is there a
Well,
plan, or is it just we're going to do some experiments and see what happens?
it's called beat the tar out of the process engineer until they get the defects down. The whole point in my mind, being a DFM disciple, is to have the discussion up front with the designers so we know what to expect. And
Well,
then
that's fair,
if we
but
have
I
to deal with minimum, we go to the line and we figure out how to deal with the minimum, or we start toying with our process parameters on this board so we don't waste production boards.
well, I mean that's fair, but I think what a lot of designers will do is we always tell designers like go talk to your manufacturer, but they probably only talk to the fabricator. Right. And then when there is a problem or a defect in assembly, the fab and the assembly are pointing their fingers at each other, and then the designer is pointing their fingers at both of them. And it's like, well, whose fault is it?
Exactly. And then with an assembly, we point fingers back and forth between the equipment and the materials as well.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah. And I think assembly probably gets the short end of the stick because, they probably don't get consulted as often as they should.
No, it's kind of like being at the end of the whip. Everything stacks up and multiplies and you get it all at the end.
But so something that could have been a fab defect doesn't become noticeable until it creates an assembly defect, and then everyone says, well, it's the assembler's fault.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. In fact, I've got a presentation that I used to give for SMTA meetings called Fab Hangovers. And it's exactly that. As a process engineer on an assembly line, you can spend a week chasing down a problem only to find out it was in the fab. So
really? How common is that?
More common than you would think. Some of the things we run into extremely often are over etch of pads. So okay. We're trying to gasket our 8 mil stencil aperture on what should be an 8 or 9 mil pad, but it's coming in at 6.
So you've designed the process for, let's say, nominal, but it really comes in under nominal.
Yes, and a lot of that is just because of the trapezoidal effect of the acid etch. So we see that all the time. Another big problem we see all the time is solder mask misregistration.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
When the solder mask climbs up on the pad, it's very difficult to print and solder to. And we see it all the time. In fact, if you look at this test right here, what we've done is mixed mask and metal defined pads, because in assembly, we want them all mask defined or all metal defined. We don't want the mix, but that's not really been communicated to the designers. So we've taken this and mixed up some mask and metal. You can't see the mask layer. I'm only showing the copper layer right now. And then we skewed the solder mask. So this is off by 1 mil in X and Y. This is offset by 2 mil in X and Y. And this is offset by 3 mil in X and Y. In fact, let me actually turn the mask on. So you can see.
Yeah, I was just going to say, can we turn the mask on? So for for those, again, listening on audio, we have some of those BGA footprints here. But then when you turn the mask on, you can actually see what would normally be that pad arrangement. And then it's overlaid, mask opening that you would typically see like an Altium designer. And then that mask opening is offset just a little bit by these amounts, 1 mil, 2 mil, and 3 mil.
Yeah, so that's the 3. That's the worst case. This is the 2. And we typically call out 2 to 3 mil registration on our specs, but we see it good registration coming out of high volume shops. We don't necessarily see good registration on the smaller volume shops.
Okay.
So that's why we decided to put this in there. And actually a really, really good process engineer from ASMPT suggested this because I've been asking people for real life situations. And, we named it after him. His name is Jeff Shake, and we're calling this Shake Up the BGAs.
This is the first time I've heard of a process named after a very well-known person in the industry.
Well, we actually...
Hopefully soon we'll have the Hartley process.
There we go. There we go. Well, it turned out on the original board, we ended up nicknaming some of the sections. You know, like the 04 BGAs, we'd call it tic-tac-toe and these type of things. So from the outset here, I decided to name the sections. For example, this here we call Tombstone Alley. This is another thing that's a DFM-related item that just does not get communicated to designers. These are capacitors, and capacitors love to tombstone. And it's because of thermal differentials across the device. So what we typically see is a metal defined pad on one side of the cap and a mask defined pad on the other. Let me see if I can bring the mask up a layer.
So just for everyone that's listening, what we have here are some big copper pore regions. And then we have some SMD components lined up around the edge of these copper pore regions. And I see here, we have some of those SMDs have a thermal attach and some of them don't. And I guess this is kind of a side-by-side comparison of the number of defects you would expect to see.
Exactly. Again, that gives us the quality metrics to have the conversation with the designers and the owners of the product. Do you want to risk the defects, or can you put the thermal relief in?
Now, here's one thing I've been dying to ask somebody about just exactly what you're showing here with tombstoning. If you go online and you start reading about, DFA, you start reading about DFM, you start reading about assembly defects, it's almost obligatory that somebody says tombstoning. And it's, I mean, they talk about it as if it's like the most common thing, and you need thermals everywhere. And no matter what you do, if you don't have a thermal, you're going to see tombstoning. How common is it really? Because I feel like it's talked about as if it's more common than it actually is.
I think you're right, because when we do tombstoning tests, we to get good sample sizes, we literally do hundreds of thousands of joints. Again, tombstoning is due in large part to this type of scenario where you've got an unequal thermal, and they will exactly tombstone, or so we're hoping. Another thing that we've also been finding lately is if you control the tombstone, you can end up with a nice solder joint on your metal-defined side and a cold joint on your mass-defined side.
I see.
So even though it's not a tombstone, it's still requiring rework. Every time we rework a board, we reduce its reliability.
Right. That makes
So
sense.
we try to avoid that at all costs. We built these tombstone alleys for our 0201 caps, our 0105 caps, and our 0804 caps. Caps are a lot more likely to tombstone than resistors because they have five-sided terminations. And the mechanism by which tombstoning occurs is the melted solder wets to one end and the surface tension just pulls it right up. So whichever side melts first is the base of the tombstone. Resistors don't tombstone as much because they only have three sides of metallization, so there's not enough metallization for not as much, let me say, metallization for the solder paste to grab. But now we've got this new phenomena that we just designed in down here, and we set it up similar to the tombstone alley. I've talked to three different assemblers in the last month who are dealing with bottom terminated Zener diodes. These are 0201 or 0008 or 0105 packages, and they have very small bottom terminations and they're very light. So what happens is, again, the side that melts first, the solder pulls it. It doesn't pull it up because it's bottom terminated. It pulls it laterally, and you will see all of these skew by the same degree in the same direction when they have the uneven thermals.
Interesting that they would all do the same thing.
Yes. And we've done things where, we'll switch orientation in the machine, or we'll switch orientation in the reflow oven, or we'll run it at 90 instead of zero, and they all still skew in the same direction. So I'm convinced it's due to thermal differentials, and that's why I put these on this revision of the board.
We only have a few minutes left, but one last question I wanted to ask you. What are some of the other tests that are going to be performed that might be exclusive to like a UHDI test vehicle?
We are planning on putting in a really just interesting, nice little window here where we have decreasing trace sizes and a mask window so you can actually see. Now, also, this board, to keep it economical and two layer for assemblers, we're running 5 mil traces.
Sure.
As you know, with Altium, we can instantly go in there and turn them all to 1 mil traces
Oh, yeah,
or
make them
2 mil
as.
traces. Or 3 mil traces. So, I mean, I shouldn't say it's just a couple clicks of the mouse because, I don't want to and salt the beauty and sophistication of this tool, but it actually illustrates the beauty and sophistication of the tool that you can go in and say, change my traces to 1 mil, 2 mils, and see how fabrication goes. I'm actually looking forward to making this board with the additive process, so that we can have those nice flat pads. If we were to look at the bottom side of the board, we've got these things called print to fail. So on the bottom side of the board, we've got these things called print to fail, and they're different sizes, shapes, and they're mask and metal defined. And we always see the trapezoid very, very clearly when we look at the metal defined ones here. And I've shown pictures of them. I don't have the presentation handy right now, but when we do half of these in additive and half of these in subtractive, we're going to be able to look at that, geez, even under a 10x ring light and see the difference. As an assembly engineer, I'm really looking forward to flat pads that are right size. I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to that.
Well, as you've mentioned, that is extremely important, especially when you start going to sub IPC standard levels. So exactly. I'm anxious to see it too. I'm sure as all this stuff develops and you start proving this out, it would be great to have you back on and we can discuss this more.
I'd love to come back on. I'd love to come back on with the actual Ultra HDI, where instead of routing on the top layer, we're routing in layers 2, 3, 6, 7.
22.
Yes.
27, right?
Yes, indeed. Let's punch all the way through to the back and then back up top through 10 layers, 20 layers. The bigger the challenge, the more fun it is.
That's
and I
awesome.
Think most engineers will tell you the same thing.
I have the same attitude. Chris, thank you so much for being here today. This has been super informative. And I encourage anyone that's listening on audio, head over to YouTube and watch the video. You'll be able to see everything that we've been talking about. It's a really great learning experience.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Anytime. For everyone that's out there listening and watching, we've been talking with Chris Shea, president of Shea Engineering. Make sure to check out the show notes. You'll see some great resources there where you can learn more about all the topics we've been talking about. Also, if you're watching on YouTube, make sure to hit the subscribe button, hit the like button, and you'll be able to keep up with all of our tutorials and podcast episodes as they come out. Last but not least, don't stop learning, stay on track, and we'll see you next time. Thanks, everyone.